was Fletcher Henderson opening up this afternoon's Fresh Air with a recording of the House of David Blues. Once a month, WUHY's station manager Bill Seemring visits Fresh Air to discuss special programs coming up and program schedule changes, and then we open up the telephones for any questions or comments you have about the programming on WUHY. Bill will be with us at about 4:20 today, and when he joins us, we'll hear a short excerpt of the program Father Cares, The Last of Jonestown, featuring tape recordings made by Jim Jones of his talks to and with the people of Jonestown, and we'll be hearing that excerpt about 4:20 today. At 3:30, Francis Davis hosts Interval, our regular Thursday feature of out-of-print jazz recordings. Today, Francis plays and discusses the New York Contemporary Five with Archie Shepp. At 3 o'clock, we'll hear another edition of the NPR Journal series on violent crime. The subject today will be domestic violence. Statistics indicate that the greatest violence to police is the result of intervention in domestic violence. This program explores why many homes have become battlefields. With me now is novelist Richard Price, author of Blood Brothers, The Wanderers, and Ladies' Man. The first two were made into films. Ladies' Man is currently being made into a film. His first novel, The Wanderers, was published in 1974 when he was 24. It was a semi-autobiographical story of lower middle-class white teenagers in the Bronx around 1960. His second novel, Blood Brothers, was published 2 years later in 76, about a family living in a lower middle-class high-rise complex in the Bronx. The main character just turned 18, and for the men in that family, that usually means becoming a construction worker. But that's a life he doesn't really want, but he's not sure how to get out of it. Ladies' Man, Price's most recent novel, came out in 1978. This one was about a man obsessed with his lover but unable to get along with her, and preoccupied with sex but unable to find satisfying encounters. Richard Price has taught at Yale. He now teaches at NYU and is an adjunct professor in fiction writing at the Columbia University School of the Arts. He's in Philadelphia today to do a reading this evening at Swarthmore College, where he will also announce the winners of the William Plummer Potter Fund Awards in fiction writing. And this will be at Swarthmore this evening at 8:15 in the Bond Building. And for any more information, you can call 447-7534. Again, that's 447-7534, and I'll be giving that information again a little later. Richard Price, welcome to Fresh Air. Did the urban stories that you have told in your fiction come out of your life, or were you kind of like the kid on the periphery watching but not really taking part in a lot of what was happening?
I think I was one step closer to the center than what you're describing, but pretty much on the peripheries. I think what's most autobiographical about my books is the texture and the music, not soundtrack music, but just the rhythms. I have a theory that most of the writers who write about men in groups and urban settings and gangs, like James Farrell, Hubert Selby, myself, tend to not have been central to the action, but were probably a little bit more withdrawn than they were the observers.
Let's talk about some of the themes and kinds of relationships that interest you in your novels. Do you want to kick it off, or should I suggest some?
Well, one of the relationships, something that keeps coming back to me most dramatically because I wrote a book about gangs is men in groups. I'm not particularly interested in gangs per se. I am interested in men in groups because I'm male, and I've had a lot of group experience. Formal group experience with other guys, and experience with isolation, which is. So, what I focus on a lot is how men talk and don't talk to each other. Through as I get older, the varying ways in which they talk and don't talk to each other, starting with teenage kids. College kids, kids at that stage where they have to decide whether they're going to follow in their father's footsteps or not, and ultimately free agents, which is, say, men over the age of 22, 23.
Some of the communication within groups involves expressions of violence, particularly, I guess, in the Warriors, in the Wanderers.
Whoops.
Whoopsie.
Major whoops.
Yes, why did you write that story about youths traveling on subways throughout New York City? No, is that something that you see happening a lot, that communication in groups of men end up sometimes to involve violence?
No, not really. See, my world has changed so much that I think the a lot of the violence that was in the Wanderers was a process of when you're younger, your juices are flowing more, and you're more you have more of a tendency towards outbursts. You don't know how to deal with a lot of the frustrations that make up your life. You know, as you get older and more sophisticated, you go for ulcers instead. I don't think violence, physical violence between men, is that common, especially in the world that I am in now. Say, like living in Manhattan, I think violence is more something affiliated with crime than sort of everyday natural expressions of things.
But do you think the way men relate to one another, particularly in groups, is in part a function of class, you know, in neighborhood?
I think it's a function of education. Sometimes I think the more speaking your mind is validated, you know, the more you'll speak your mind. The more, you know, posturing and stoicism is considered the way to go. Then you'll have things, you know, coming out. Then you have that poetry of dissociation, what people say when they really can't say something. You know, the verbal glancing blows, which I find more interesting as a writer myself. I'm more into people who are a little choked, simply because what they wind up doing is more poetic and more metaphorical. It's almost like dreams, you know, how like your dreams are constantly sort of telling you things that you can't really say in your conscious day. These people are walking around sometimes in dream states where they're speaking through metaphors, even though they don't even know what a metaphor is.
A lot of your characters, male characters, are really obsessed with sex, with either their lover or mm-hmm. more casual encounters, but a lot of them also seem really unable to find a fulfilling experience that meets the kind of thing that they're really preoccupied with. There's a lot of frustration.
Yeah. Well, see, the thing around sex is that I think it's the easiest form of human contact. It's like being a writer almost. You know, like you get, or being anything in being any kind of sort of public figure in the arts, you're getting loved by the maximum number of people for the minimal amount of effort. You know, like you don't have to work on getting to know anybody. You know, if we're talking about sex and not love, and so I think a lot. You know, without going into generalities, but I think you know a lot of people, especially since they, at this point in our lives, our age group, marriage is not a given. But we have not been given any alternatives to strive for. So we're at sea a bit. You know. And sex seems like the most immediate thing that you can grab onto. And then it gets rough, I think. Sex is sort of like the easiest thing you can do with somebody.
Do you try to have your characters, like, learn something by the end of the book? Or have the readers get something to hold on to, like a not exactly a moral, but to have conceptually undergone the transformation that the characters did and come out knowing more?
Yeah, yes. I don't know how conscious I am of that, but I feel like every book is about an education. It has to be. I think I'm not for Panaceas, and I won't have you know my characters come out anointed or anything for their troubles because it just doesn't happen that way. But decisions will be made, even if they're very baby step sized decisions. Where I'll have, let's say, like in Ladies' Man, with a character who's obsessed with sex because he needs something, but he doesn't really want to put out that much, decides that he has to move on and try something a little bit harder, like friendship. A lot of people misinterpreted the ending, thinking that he decided to try homosexual sex, and that's not what I meant. All you people out there, three of you who read the book and two of you who don't get the ending. So he makes that decision to try for a friend where sex is not an issue. Blood Brothers, it's a point in a 18-year-old kid's life where he has to decide to go out on his own and break away from the romance of the family, and he succumbs and he does not break away. That's his decision. But a lot of people feel like my books sort of come to dilemma ends. You know, like everybody's sitting there with a giant question mark over their head with their head in their hands, and it's not. I don't see it that way, but I just can't make too much of it. I think E.M. Forster said in Aspects of the Novel, at the college, and I read E.M. Forster, and he said that the weakest part of any novel is the ending, because that's the part where the novel becomes most unreal in terms of the way life really is. Things don't tie up, you know. There isn't, you know, there aren't, you know, double knot big bows of therefores at the end. And I have to have something, you know, so it sort of ends. You know, I got to have some kind of punchline, but I don't want to make too big a point out of it, because I don't know that much myself.
Do people assume that the troubles that your characters have or troubles that you have, you know, that, for instance, you share your characters' obsessions or frustrations?
Yeah. Well, what happens now, the funny thing is that each book, as I get older, my characters get older, and I can't write about the dilemma of a 40-year-old man who's been divorced, because I'm not 40, I'm 31, I've never been married. I can write about a 31-year-old, the world of a 31-year-old, you know, who's moderately successful in what he does, which I could not have written about 10 years ago when I was 21. So each book has sort of traced my growth, hopefully not in a narcissistic way. It's just all I know is what I've lived. I'm not one of those people who can say, for example, like Robert Coover, who's into like, you know, like The Public Burning, or Stanley Elkin, who's into wild speculative satire. I am much more focused on what I see right in front of my face, and I'm much more into photography than I am into painting.
You write, your characters are, for the most part, lower middle class people who speak street language. And a lot of people will pick up a book with street language in it and assume, oh, this is like drugstore novel kind of trash. Look at the way these characters speak.
Well, not as many as you might think. I've heard of situations where people, you know, I'll do like a reading and I think, you know, I just, you know, tore the lid off the breaking through from dramatic art to the novel, and I should have gotten an Academy Award for this reading I've just given, and somebody, the first reaction I'll get is like, you know, how come you use that word so much? And I just feel like, and, you know, it's post-Hiroshima, like, who cares about, you know, if you use a four-letter word or not, you know? Also, I just feel like that has been broken through by so many people. I mean, obscenity, I mean, you know, then you get into that whole issue of like, well, what's obscene, violence or sex, or, you know, like, you know, what's G, what's R, you know, the whole thing of like, you know, sex is bad, but violence is okay. And so, you know, I don't really care. I speak like that. I'm having a hernia right now, trying not to curse, but I mean, not, you know, but this is the way I speak, and it's the way I think, and it's sort of the music. I find some music in that language, and it would be a strain for me to feel like I have to admit it to show that I'm quote-unquote maturing, you know. I mean, I think you can overuse it, but I don't think about it when I use it. I just use it.
Since characters, particularly in your first two books, are in the process of becoming adults or becoming men, and they have to kind of define what adulthood or manhood means, let me ask what it meant to you when you were growing up, what your concept of a man was.
Very juvenile. It's still probably very juvenile. It was very tied up in, it was the type that you are torn between the wrongness of Vietnam and wondering if you would be man enough to do combat, and you don't know which is more important to you. That's the best way I can. He who is the toughest, the biggest, has the most respect. You know, a kid who's bright is basically bright but doesn't hold any awe. I think that's also validated on a lot of the TV I watched when I was a kid, you know, like the rescue type characters and the hero types. And, you know, it has to do a lot with a lot of that sexual hysteria you feel when you're 14. You know, it's such a physical feeling that, you know, who cares if you can do the theory of relativity backwards? You just want to have, like, you know, big pecs, big lats, and big biceps. And, you know, I can't say I feel that way anymore, but I can still smell it, you know, it's not that far away. And I would be lying to say that I'm still not vulnerable to that sort of stuff.
Oh, what happened when feminism came along? Did that put you in any kind of confrontation with what you thought of manhood or of
No, not really, because I wasn't. It wasn't a matter of like I am the man and my house is my castle and we got a Napoleonic code here. And, you know, it wasn't like a Stanley Kowalski thing for me. I thought, you know, I was very at the time when feminism was being read about and discussed, and it seemed there was like a newness to it, which is sort of the '60s, I guess. You know, I thought it made. I was very excited by anything that's psychosociological new thoughts I could have about the way people are, and it made a lot of sense to me. I mean, it didn't particularly threaten me. It didn't, you know. I mean, I don't know. I didn't particularly threaten too many people I knew, but I feel like, it deceptively so, feminism is still, you know, primarily in the urban areas more. You know, my experience. Women are still the women that they were in the 1940s when I go out to different areas of the country. You know, I think we have tendencies to feel like places like New York or Philadelphia or Los Angeles, you sometimes lose touch with what's going on in the real country. And, of course, in Manhattan, you know, I'm going to see things, but it's really not America. But, you know, getting back just to I didn't feel anything particularly threatening about feminism. I just thought it made sense and, you know, it wasn't like I was, you know, going home and, you know, belching all over my wife or, you know, taking out, cleaning my shotgun while she was doing the dishes or not letting her work, you know, something like that, or refusing to use birth control because I was, you know, I was a good Catholic or something, you know.
What about people who you grew up with in the neighborhood? Do you have contact with people from there?
I don't hang out with people that I grew up with simply because, not because I feel like, you know, I've gone the way of the arts, and you know, but it's just we've just gone separate paths. I mean, the Bronx is not Manhattan. I mean, it's the provinces, you know. And just to live in Manhattan is a choice that will separate you from people who want to, you know, go for the suburban lifestyle, or say Queens or Long Island or Westchester. And the people I grew up with, they all, you know, became, you know, basically, you know, middle class successful people. I think I probably did like the most flamboyant thing of anybody, you know, by being a writer, but you know, they're all doing all right, I guess.
Do you ever go back to the neighborhood? Do you still have family there?
No. I do go back to the neighborhood. You know, and I go on these nostalgia things, but I mean, I'm so aware of them as being nostalgia things that it's almost artificial. I think it's very important for a writer. I heard Larry McMurtry say this about his own work, and McMurtry he wrote a lot of books about small towns in Texas, but he felt that the very thing that can launch a young writer's career, which is, say, writing about his turf, you know, which is a dusty town, Last Picture Show, or The Wanderers, or, you know, The Loop in Chicago, or if the very thing that can launch you, if you don't get away from it, in a couple of books will strangle you. And I find in my own work, more and more I need not to just have different scenes, like, well, now I'm going to do Nebraska or something, but I need more and more to go internal. I need to have interior landscapes more. I need to, as I get older, I feel like I have more thoughts about what's going on inside and more universal thoughts. And it's not that important to me to be, you know, the neighborhood writer. I mean, I love it. I love texture. I love having. I feel like I have a really good ear, and I will always use it. And I like the vernacular, and I like small details. But if I can do it for the Bronx, I can do it anywhere. And I've had my say about the Bronx.
One of your characters, the lead character in Ladies' Man, goes to the Carnegie Cinema in one scene to that little. Chic but weird restaurant downstairs where they have all the cappuccino and all these like phony French posters.
Just the wall where they paint the wall like it's a French street, and then they hang canopies out. It's almost like a painting.
And it's just really funny the way you place him in there, because he's like all wrong for this really kind of kitschy Parisian chic, all of those rolled into one setting. Do you ever feel out of place yourself in, like, chic New York?
Only when the bill comes. No, in fact, I think I feel more out of place in the Bronx right now. And it's not a matter of, like, you know, attitude, you know, like, oh, I'm too big for the Bronx or something like that. The Bronx, I've been out of the Bronx since I've been 18. My life has changed. And I can go home and I can, you know, talk to people and hang out and stuff, but I don't particularly want to because I find like, my daily life is made up of different things. And I can't, if my life is shop, I can't talk shop that much with people, you know. So I feel much more comfortable in Manhattan, you know, because that's where I have been living. That's where the last 10 years of my life have been, which were just as tender as the 10 years previous in terms of like, you know, from 21 to 31. You know, I mean, just as many intense, unforgettable things have happened, you know, and that's where I am now.
This is an unfair question because writers shouldn't be put on the spot to comment about other writers unless they want to, so just tell me you don't want to answer this, but if you're willing to answer it, have you read Avery Corman's novels, and what do you think of it?
I've not read Avery Corman's novels. I've seen Kramer versus Kramer. Do you want me to talk about that? Or
sure.
You know? Yeah. I thought it was okay. I didn't, you know, like, I know it. I was a little uncomfortable with Meryl Streep being the bad guy. You know, I feel like there's two sides to that story. And I feel a little suspect of pictures and books that capitalize on, quote-unquote, the way we live now. Like anything with Jill Clayburgh in it, for example. You know, I kind of feel like as anything, it's like, okay, what can we do next, you know? That is the trend, you know. It's like Trendland, you know. And Kramer versus Kramer, for all you know, it's good stuff. And I felt like I had a lot of good stuff. I felt a little self-consciously addressing itself to the way we live now, and as such, was a little exploitative.
Okay, I was also interested in. He wrote a book which I haven't read about.
Oh, the
back
old
to
neighborhood.
The Bronx.
Oh,
yeah.
I know about that book, and I heard it was pretty decent. But I can't, not having read it.
What kind of scenes interest you in Manhattan now?
Jesus, everything. I mean, the thing about New York for me is every time you're walking down the street, there are 17 novels walking the other way.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, people.
Novels
just,
or novelists?
Novels. I mean, like, every person's a novel. Every person's got their, you know, I mean, it's just, I can't, I mean, in fact, I'm trying to write now about a kid who goes to the village for the first time in his life. Nothing to do with Paul Mazursky, please. But, you know, and it's just, I have such a glut of things that I, you know, and I mean, the difficulties in editing down images to, you know, something fast and, you know, cohesive. I like hanging out with writers. I'm not supposed to say that, I guess, because I'm with the real people, you know what I'm saying? But I do feel, I like other writers. I mean, they took the same life choice that I did. They have a lot of the same tendencies that I have, you know, in terms of they have the same eye. I'm not saying the same taste, but they all have that same instincts that I have. And I don't hang out exclusively with writers, but, you know, I enjoy the company of at least professional peers, you know. Anything, everything. You know, Vincent Patrick, who wrote The Pope of Greenwich Village, is a friend of mine, and I teach at Columbia University in the writing program there. And I had Vince Patrick come into my class to talk about his own experiences, and he said that what he realized is that once you become a success, you should never forget the importance of taking a subway as opposed to a cab every now and then. And I guess that's what I feel like, there's all these subways I can take in New York.
Mm-hmm. Let me reintroduce you for our listeners just tuning in. I'm talking with novelist Richard Price, and he's the author of The Wanderers and Ladies' Man and Blood Brothers. Ladies' Man is being made into a film, and the other two have been made into films. And he's in Philadelphia today to do a reading at Swarthmore this evening at 8:15. Was it considered unusual amongst the people you grew up with to be a writer?
Yeah. Now, see, there are a lot of misconceptions about where I grew up from The Wanderers because of the violence in it. People assumed it was some kind of, like, ghetto slum life. It wasn't. It was lower middle class, racially mixed, religiously mixed, lowest steerage guys. and their families. And but you know, we had meat on the table every night, and everybody went to school as much as they wanted to go to school. There was nobody who could not go to college if they chose to. Not many people went to Europe in the summer. Everybody worked, but you know, it was basically a normal situation. What was the question again?
Was it unusual to be a writer?
Oh, okay, now, but this is where the difference comes in, say, between upper middle class and lower middle class people, which is that I think for the lower middle class people whose parents have not gone to college, the focus on getting an education and getting a job is much more oriented towards blue chip professions such as law school, engineering school, medical school, something because people have gone through the Depression, which is sort of a cliche at this, you know, to say, but because people have gone through the Depression and they don't have a lot of money, they have sort of enough, they're very financially security oriented, so they push for their kids to go into, you know, the safer jobs. So the arts get shortchanged in lower middle class options for kids like myself when I was 18, 19, 20. In fact, I got a degree in labor relations, and only at the very last minute did I go to Columbia for fine arts, but I was going to go to Harvard for educational administration or this, that, the other, something I knew I was going to get a paycheck at. So when I wrote the book, I think part of the success of the book was that nobody was writing about these people because nobody coming out of that background really felt like they had that option to pursue art. You know, they're all lawyers and doctors, which is fine. But I think the next generation, like my kids, I don't have kids now, but when I will have kids, and the children of my friends, hopefully, will feel like they have more of a choice. It also depends on the economy at the time, too. You know.
You know what I've always thought part of the reason why it's hard at least to get parental understanding or support for going into the arts is, you know, when you're from a middle-class background, is because a lot of times it's really easy to assess if you're a doctor or a lawyer.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know what that is, but if you write novels or do paintings, for in a family where there aren't a lot of trips to the museum or people don't sit around reading novels, there's no telling whether it's good or bad or anything. There's just no way of measuring what it is that you do.
Yeah, I think, you know, to my experience, people have respect for the arts, but, I mean, it takes so long to be successful, you know, in terms of, like, anybody graduating law school and getting a job as a clerk, you know, for a law firm is automatically a lawyer. So around the Mahjong table, mom can say, yeah, he's a lawyer. You know, but if you're going to be a writer and you're 23, you might have to be waiting on tables or bartending for 7 years. And what's your mother going to say at the Mahjong table? You know, and there's a lot of pressure to please, you know. And I think that scares kids away from, you know, it's a gamble. Anybody in the arts is a gambler. You know, and you're gambling with your life and there's no money back guarantee. You know, I have students now and I can see, like, at least on my undergraduate students, the very best of them might not become writers simply because they can't bring themselves to take that gamble when, if they're smart enough to be a good writer, they're also smart enough to get into a prestigious law school, which seems so much safer. You know, I always say, look, you know, give it a couple of years. What do you have to lose? Because you don't do it now, the older you get, the harder it's going to be. Even if you're a failed writer for a couple of years and then you go to law school, it's a lot better than being a lawyer. And at 45 years old, you're kicking yourself saying, what if, what if, what if? At least you know what if. You flunked, you failed, you made it, you didn't make it.
The famous streetwise writer from the old neighborhood is Sylvester Stallone now, right, who kind of plays himself in movies, mm-hmm. and who plays himself in public appearances, too. Do you feel any relationship with that, or do people expect that you're going to be him, this, like, really big, brawny, muscular hunk of a guy?
Yeah, I feel like constantly, I feel like people are disappointed a lot when they find out I'm Jewish and not Italian, because that sort of cuts my macho quota down a little bit, you know, and I only weigh 142 pounds, which also disappoints people. I think, you know, the most masculine macho thing about me is the fact that I talk out of my sinuses, so it makes it sound like, you know, I'm from Hell's Kitchen or something, but it's this constant, it's very funny, I you know, when people meet me, I feel like I'm constantly disappointing them, you know, which is really awful, you know, it's terrible for me. And I was just talking about sort of like that hangover of adolescent imagery of being male. It's like I'm like the world's skinniest weightlifter. I work out in a gym in a village, and there's like 11 of me makes one of any of them. You know, there are guys whose triceps are bigger than my whole head, you know. But I know three-quarters of the reason why I'm doing it is that's still that hangover from being 17, you know.
If you don't mind my mentioning this, you're wearing, like, jeans and, like, a T-shirt kind of thing. And do you ever feel pressure to, you know, become more of the dress for success kind of artist who's reached a certain status and has to, like, fit that status image, which is, of course, the different image from the guy from the old neighborhood, but I mean, now, you know, you teach at graduate schools and do readings at universities.
Well, I got a sport jacket for tonight in my, I'm not going to, you know, I've just, you know, figured where, you know, nobody can see me.
For me,
so.
You wouldn't put it on, huh?
I'll put it on if you want to wait, but no, I don't know, I feel very, my day does not take me to places in which I have to be formally dressed.
And yeah.
So I don't really ever feel the need. Also, maybe it's like a secret way of feeling like you're still young because you're wearing dungarees, you know.
Well, you were really young when your first novel was published. You were 24.
Yeah, I was three. I was 24.
That's really young for a first novel.
Yeah.
How was it greeted? Because I think, like in every field, there's a lot of jealousy in writing. Mm-hmm. And I think frequently when someone that young gets published and their novel is received well, that there's a lot of applause and acclaim, but also a lot of backbiting.
If there was, I didn't pick up on a lot of it because I was so naive. I was still in graduate school, and to me, it felt like I just did the world's greatest graduate paper, you know, and I was so good it was getting. It didn't feel like, I didn't even feel like I was out in the world yet. So, and I didn't really have a sense of like how hard it is in the struggle. That writing is for, you know, a lot of people. And I felt like I was very lucky. And I felt like if I did know more and if I was a little bit hipper about what the real story is with making it as a writer, I might have gone to law school. But, you know, so I think my naivete saved me because I didn't see a lot of possibly ugly stuff around me, or I didn't, you know, I didn't get a chance to get discouraged. I was very lucky. And I feel when I keep telling my students, don't expect to walk out of this program into a novel. I feel like there's a danger of me sounding, you know, like postured because I did. But in the last couple of years, I've been thinking about it a lot because I'm older now and I'm looking. And a lot of my friends who are getting published now, their first books are my age. You know, when they were 24, they were scrapping. You know, and I'm the only person I know, you know, who lucked out that way. So it's tricky because I know my case was rare.
Well, you had the once a year, like once a year, usually someone really young writes a novel that's well received.
Yeah. See, the thing is, I don't think it was a combination of things. I mean, assume that, you know, I assume I had the talent. I mean, you know, but a lot of people have the talent. But I really think it's a matter of what I was saying before, which is that a lot of people coming out of my background don't write about that stuff. So it caused sort of a splash. I mean, a lot of people said, well, you know, since Last Exit to Brooklyn or since, you know, Studs Lonergan. Like I said, I had the market to myself. I guess I mean the word market, you know, kind of facetiously, but nobody was writing about. I mean, if I was writing about, you know, the college blues, you know, like, sexual madcap stuff, you know, Kingsley Amis type stuff, a la New York City, I think the book would have gotten lost, you know. So I think it was the subject as much as anything else, you know.
I'm talking to Richard Price, if you're just joining us. Two of your novels have become films, been made into films, and one of them is in the process now. Have you been satisfied with the films of Blood Brothers and the Wanderers?
Well, Blood Brothers, they had to drag me out of there in a straitjacket, screaming. I mean, I really hated it. I liked all the actors. I thought they were all misdirected. I thought what they did was, I was 26 years old at the time I wrote the book, and what they did is that they took all the bad things in the book, which is, say, like the tendencies towards melodrama, and they exploded them 80 feet tall on the screen, and they threw out all the good qualities. So when I was looking up, it was like I was seeing a parody of my own weaknesses as a writer, you know, with none of the redeeming factors, you know. But, you know, also writers are not supposed to like their movies. The last time I was in Philadelphia, the Walnut Street Theater, they had that men's, you know, sort of like a men's lib type weekend, and they got a copy of the film Blood Brothers, and they wanted me to speak afterwards. I could hardly watch the picture. I got up there and I ranted and raved for an hour about how this is like a horrible picture, and they, you know, sold out the book, blah, 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 you know. People were sort of listening to me, and finally one guy raised his hand and said, "Listen, I'm almost afraid to say this, but I kind of like the movie. Can we just take like a hand count to see if anybody else liked the movie?" And 5-6 of the audience raised their hand, so like I spent the next hour like apologizing. But, to ask the writer what you think is, I don't know. You know, you can see movies that everybody loves, like Midnight Cowboy, and then you can talk to the author, James Leo Hurley, here, the novel. Midnight Cowboy, and he hates it. And he said, "How could you hate that? It was such a great movie," because he wrote the book. When you're sitting there, you're watching the deviation from every semicolon, every comma, every time they take two characters and put them together as one for convenience's sake, every time they took something out of the book because it might think it won't go over in Des Moines or it's too distasteful, you flip a little bit. But you can't go into Hollywood, you can't go into the movies as a novelist, because you're setting yourself up. You have to be realistic about it. It's a different art form. It's got different needs. It's big bucks. It's millions of dollars they're playing with. You are the person that they care about the least. I mean, I couldn't even get invited to the screening of Blood Brothers.
No kidding.
Well, I mean, everybody's sitting there biting their nails. You're only as good as your last movie, and they just put $8 million into this movie. The last thing that they wanted to be distracted by was a furious novelist. You know, I had nothing to do with that, and they didn't want me singing "Look What They Done to My Song, Ma," you know. Around The Wanderers, they changed it a lot too. But I didn't mind it that much. I think they were very scared of the Warriors, it's the tail end of that gang movie glut that happened in 2 years ago. And the Warriors, although it did very good at the box office, got a lot of bad copy because there was some violence, some murdering actually in movie lobbies across the country. So what they had, they got real nervous, and they changed The Wanderers from some kind of Mean Streets type thing, which would have been much better, I think, to sort of like a lightweight summer entertainment thing. You know, get Gay and Wilson to do these funny little ads, you know, and get Jack Davis to do some more funny little ads, and we'll have these big silly gangs, and don't worry, they're not really going to hurt you, you know. And but nonetheless, I do feel like there was a lot of good things in there that they did capture a lot. In fact, I think the best thing in the whole movie was this makeout party, this strip poker game at a makeout party, which I didn't even write. That was purely Phil Kaufman's work, who was the director. And I thought that was much better than anything that I had to contribute. I was also in the film. I had a little small part as a lounge lizard. I got strangled with my own tie. That was kind of fun. I liked the picture better. It was not my book, and it got slammed for not being my book, which is, you know, thanks everybody, but no thanks, you know, like, you know. But that's it, you know, you take your money, you take your chances, and you can't scream, you know, integrity, integrity. If you're that worried about integrity, then don't give it to the movies.
But I guess you're still involved with movies, because Ladies' Man...
Yeah, I love movies. I have not necessarily fallen in love with the interpretations of my own books, but I would say that as a writer, I have been influenced as much by Martin Scorsese as I have anybody whose medium is the printed page. I feel like the two major influences on my writing have been Lenny Bruce and Martin Scorsese. I feel like William Burroughs, John Raschi, Jack Kerouac, Hubert Selby, the sort of ashcan realists of the 30s. Also, I'm not trying to be flippant, you know, but I was born in 1949. I grew up watching Miss Frances' Ding Dong School, and my whole frame of reference for telling a story was visual. So when I I could not read a lot of the 19th century writers because their world was much more of a world of words, and I found myself getting impatient. I'm not proud of that fact, but I mean, that's part of the casualty of growing up on TV, is that you can't read Henry James, you can't read Hardy, you even have a hard time with Dickens. You want speed, you know, I want a movie, I want words coming out my ears and my eyes. So when I started writing books, I wrote like I received information. That's how I wanted to give information, real fast, just keep it coming. You know, trust, if translate everything into dramatics, and, you know, dramatic metaphor, and let people figure out for themselves what it's about, but just make it fast. I really, I like speed. I like listening to music when I'm writing. You know, I'm really a media child, you know, and I think you'll see more and more of that coming up because, well, my generation, we're early 30s, late 20s now, and we are starting to become the artists of the day, and you will see more and more of that, I think.
So you grew up on television. Are you worried about kids now growing up on television?
I'm just worried about kids growing up, period. You know, no, I don't know. I mean, I don't have kids, so I don't really see that television didn't hurt me. Or maybe it did. I mean, you know, right now it might be something, you know, else, but I've also read a lot. The weirdest thing I've ever heard around kids being swamped, you know, with media blitzes, in some elementary school out in California during a spelling test, the teacher asked the kids to spell relief, and half the class spelt it R-O-L-A-I-D-S. And I saw something really terrifying on TV, which is this Rich Little had an impersonator's hour on Home Box Office, and he had a four-year-old kid up there who can do 24 imitations of, you know, Fred Sanford, Red Fox, you know. He could do Mae West, he could do Carter. And, like, but this kid, when he wasn't doing the impressions, he was not home. I mean, it was like Jerzy Kosinski's being there. I mean, this kid was just, he was a cathode. He was like a cathode with hair. I mean, it was scary. You know, oh, it's wonderful, isn't he? He can do great. This kid's going to wind up on a funny farm in 2 weeks. Mm. You know, so that stuff scares me.
You know, one of the things I thought was really funny is in The Wanderers, you have part of the people who belong to this gang and their friends going to see West Side Story. I thought that was really funny.
Oh, yeah. I didn't even realize I did that. I mean, when you're writing, a lot of times, you're going on automatic pilot. Like, some people will... I mean, I did so many things, like, I didn't realize... Nabokov voices, I always wait for my reviews to come out to see what I wrote about, you know? And I've picked up so many ingenious things that I've done, you know, from what people have... You know, for example, just little things. In Blood Brothers, I had parallel bars, you know, like where the kid would hang out with his bar crowd and the father and the uncle would hang out with their sort of like more middle-aged, hard-hat bar crowd, and the kid was more with 18-year-old, you know, provincial disco crowd. But one bar was called Banyan's, you know, an Irish bar, and the other bar was called D'Artagnan's. And just Banyan's with D'Artagnan's, you know. Sometimes it's real, you know, I didn't realize I did that, you know. But sometimes it's embarrassing because, you know, somebody who will have been reading my work very carefully will hit me with all these questions, you know, all the symbolism and stuff. And I really have to be honest to say that, well, wow, look at that, lucky me. You really have to trust yourself when you're writing. Sometimes it's bad to understand too much of what you're working for because then the impulse to be too cut and dry about it and you lose some of the magic. You know, and so I try to keep myself kind of fuzzy-headed, you know, and working more through colors that are coming through me than, you know, well, I have to express this psychodynamic here, and you just got to trust yourself and just go with what caught your eye. Mm-hmm. You know, it'll all come out, hopefully.
I take it you don't really hang out in, quote, the film world since you've had little to do with the film so far.
Yeah, no, I don't.
Does it seem to you like there's a...
I know about that world, but...
Does it seem like there's a big difference between the literary world and the film world?
Well, it's a funny thing. I mean, people have, like, wrong impressions of the film world. To my experience, everybody in the film world is like me. They've all come from Brooklyn and the Bronx and, you know, sort of like working-class, middle-class families. And they, at the age of 40... They're producers or they're, you know, they're technicians or soundmen or screenwriters. And, but they're not, they don't come from different worlds. In fact, they all come from New York. Everybody out there has got that Saul Steinberg poster of like 9th Avenue, 10th Avenue, the world, that New Yorker magazine cover. I mean, bagel factories are probably like the biggest business out there. I mean, you know, they're all sort of like semi-apologetic for being out there, but that's where the work is. I got to be out here, you know. God, I love New York. What's happening in New York? You know, but they all, you know, nobody really, and the minute they know you're from New York, they get angry because they feel like you're dumping on them just by existing, you know. I mean, they're so like they're constantly, you know, justifying themselves to themselves. But basically, you know, like, temperament-wise, you know, they're not any different than the writers. They're just sort of creative people who took a different bent. I mean, they're more businessmen out there than there are creative people, especially on the, you know, producers. It's money. It's big money. But Hollywood, I think, is also very much a very boring company town. People work like dogs. I mean, what you hear about is like National Enquirer stuff, you know, like, you know, Helter Skelter, you know, and, you know, drugs and this, that, the other. But everybody, unless it's me and I just don't get invited to the right parties because I dress like this, but it's really like movie people hang out with movie people, TV people. It's a ghetto. I mean, it's occupational ghettos, you know, and nobody ever sees anybody who doesn't do anything that they don't do. Making movies is very hard. It's very boring. It's a lot of hurry up and wait. It's a lot of hard work. It's a lot of math. It's a lot of accounting. People have big homes, but I feel like they're primarily workaholics, and it's a company town. It's like Washington, D.C., except they're not lawyers. They're in the film industry.
You know how sometimes novels are written based on movies?
Yeah, novelizations.
Novelizations, yeah. Do you ever think of how the novelization of one of the books that were based, one of the movies that were based on one of your books would compare with your book?
Oh, yeah, it would be all different. The funny thing is, the picture I took the most offense to, Blood Brothers, would have been the closest.
Really?
Because what they did was they grafted a lot of the dialogue, you know, and physically the characters looked right. The casting was real good, you know. But they got it all messed up somehow. I don't understand it because it was like they were making fun of it. It was so close, and it came out as a parody. Whereas in The Wanderers, I thought they really took dramatic changes. They eliminated characters. They squashed characters together. They shifted around incidents. They dropped incidents. The Wanderers would be an entirely different read as a movie tie-in.
Mm-hmm.
But Blood Brothers might be somewhat similar to the book.
How do you feel as a viewer when you've read a book and go to see the film based on it? Do you have any stake as... just as an observer of all of this and the film being faithful?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, because, I mean, it's so much a part, you know, of what I have to deal with. I'm always looking for who can do... I'm looking for people to work with, in a way. I mean, you know, at some point, I want to work. I want to do screenplays, original screenplays.
Do you? Yeah.
I want to do anything, everything. I mean, writing is, like, really isolated and lonely, and I feel like I want to do something that involves more people. You know, I want to do a play, and that's why I teach a lot. You know, journalism, plays... theater. The only thing is, the more small term, the work you do, like teaching, the more small term the hassles and diversions are. And, you know, you want to go for big bucks, you want to go for you know, big involvement, you're going to have bigger hassles. So I'm trying to, so that's why I teach, just keep it on the level so, like, my work still has, you know, primary importance. But if I have read the book, I'm always comparing it to the book. I can't help it. I mean, it's like saying, don't think of a pink elephant, you know, but people have to realize, novelists especially, if they choose to work out there in any way, you cannot be a novelist. You have to hang up your novelist hat out in the hallway before you walk into the room, because you're gonna be postured, you're gonna be on your horse, and you're gonna be holier than thou, and everybody's gonna hate you. And you're going to hate yourself. And if you're going to do it, just do it and shut up.
You have an essay about advice to young writers, and I think it's called Go for the Throat. Is that
basically
well, that what you
was,
tell them?
No. Go for the Throat, that article I wrote for The Voice, which is also coming out in an anthology of essays on writing, is was about the type of writing that I felt younger people should do. In other words, they should not emulate people like Donald Barthelme. But they should write naturalistically, because to focus too much on style as opposed to substance too early, it's like all dressed up and no place to go. So I feel like, show me you can paint the barn before you do Jasper Johns, you know, just, you know, paint my room before
you think
go
that's
for
important?
Whitney. Yes, I believe so, because I feel like because people bypass the fundamentals. People rush into writing before they have anything to say. Especially with younger writers, there's the writing, the biggest sin of writing is derivativeness, because they don't explore their own experience, you know, or if they do, they don't do it in a way that's unique or something. It's just too much, like, you know, well, I'll get the blues for this girl down to Florida, you know. I'd rather have my students write about the world that they know rather than, well, I'm going to transcend that. I'm more interested in Robespierre and Barthelme. I mean, the strength of somebody like Barthelme is Barthelme, not his writing style, but his individual mind. Raymond Carver had an article about this in the Sunday Times, you know, advice to students, sort of, which I agree with. It's that the people that kids are intellectually attracted to the most, to emulate, are the biggest dead ends for them, because these people are individual special cases. You can't write like William Burroughs. You can't write like Donald Barthelme. You can't write like... I mean, it's easy to write like me, you know, because it's my stuff is more sort of blunt and out there, you know. But I'm not saying people should write like me either. But I'm just saying, man, if you got to pick up on a style, pick up on one that's not so focused on style. You know, the story keeps getting bypassed in young writers.
Talking with Richard Price, if you're just joining us, and in a few minutes we're going to be hearing this documentary from NPR Journal about violence within families, and I know that that's a subject you've been researching for a novel that you're working on. As a novelist, what are you interested in finding out about like men who
batter
wives?
One of the elements in the book that I'm working on right now is about a couple, a batterer and a battery. And I have written about this before, like in Blood Brothers, but I felt like I really didn't know what I was talking about. I mean, it was almost like something that everybody sort of takes tongue-in-cheek, just like with Raging Bull. It's like, oh, yeah, he smacked her around, blah, blah. And I felt like I did the same thing in Blood Brothers. I just, you know, those guys, well, you smack your wife, you know. But I started reading up, and I started talking to women that actually did have histories of getting beaten up by their husbands or lovers. And I talked to a lot of counselors who work with these women. And I felt I was part of the problem around that stuff, is that I felt like it's, you know, something you can just sort of throw in there, you know, which is to say something you just sort of accept and you don't take. Well, you know, people raise their hands and that's that. But I'm in the process of learning what my main focus is, why these people stay together, the dynamics that hold them together. I don't know what to say. I mean, I'm not an authority on the subject, but I feel like I could never, ever write a quick scene involving violence between man and a woman again. It's because there's just too much to it. And it's never a given.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just use it as a prop. It's just, and that's part of the problem with it. With battered wives, is that people do feel like, so what? You know, that's a man's right. Or not even that's a man's right, that's life. And that's not life, that's death. You know, and the cycle will continue with the syndrome of the kids. What the very interesting thing, I'm always interested in kids and the next generation coming up. And what somebody once explained to me is that what happens with kids when they see their mothers getting beaten up is that the kids tend to side with the father a lot of times. The reason being is that kids very strongly believe in a world of justice and order because they're so vulnerable. If anybody's going to get smacked, it's because that person was a bad person. Now, if that person is getting smacked and that person was a bad person, was not a bad person, what's to prevent little Danny from getting smacked? And the world's in chaos, and Danny is terrorized. So therefore, kids, to preserve the order, will see Daddy hitting Mommy and be mad at Mommy and take Daddy's side, you know. And that's really scary to me, both for the kid and for the adults. And also, the other thing is the whole notion of love. People who have gotten hit when they were kids, who have been around violence, that cycle repeating itself through generations, that whole battered child syndrome. I feel like the less I say about it, the more comfortable I will be, because I don't know that much about it. But I would say that's one of the more jarring things that has stuck in my mind, yeah. You know.
That's interesting. We really have no time left, but there's one other thing I wanted to ask you. Since your first book was about your teenage experience, and since you're really not a teenager anymore, you're like 31 now,
yeah.
Right? Do you feel any bond with teenagers who you see now, or is their experience very different from the one you had?
It's fun. I do readings, and I'll do readings at places where a lot of kids from the Bronx, like Westchester Community College, which draws a lot of students from the Bronx, or Fordham University, which is in the Bronx. They look the same. I mean, the clothes have slightly changed. The accents are the same. I think the kids right now are very similar to the kids in their early 60s. And, you know, like, I guess you've probably heard this a trillion times or thought about this a trillion times, but that bubble of the late 60s, early 70s was really a transcendent moment in history. And these kids, I mean, it's deja vu, you know. I mean, they might be a little bit more liberal about drugs, but I don't even think they're even more liberal about sex. I'm talking about working class kids from fairly, you know, respectful religious, you know, silent majority, whatever you want to call it, backgrounds. And it's very much, I mean, it's like Vietnam has never happened. Like Iran, the experience of Iran has wiped out the self-criticism of Vietnam. So it's almost back to that unquestioning patriotism again, mm-hmm. you know.
Do you know when your new novel will be completed? There's probably no way of telling yet.
I hope within the next 6 months.
I look forward to it. I'm really glad you came today. Thanks very much for coming.
Thank you for having me.
I've been talking with Richard Price, and he's got three novels, The Wanderers, Blood Brothers, and Ladies' Man, and Ladies' Man's being made into a film. The other have been made into films. And what brought him to Philadelphia today was a reading this evening at Swarthmore, which will be taking place at 8:15 in the Bond Building. And if you'd like any more information about this reading, you can call 447-7534. Again, that's 447-7534. And I believe all three of your books are published by Houghton Mifflin?
Yeah, they're on paper, too.
Right, good. Okay, thanks again for talking with us.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. It's a minute to three, and you're tuned to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. In about an hour and 20 minutes, Bill Seemring, WUHY station manager, will be with us for his monthly appearance on Fresh Air to talk about special upcoming programs, program schedule changes, and we'll open up the telephone lines for any questions or comments that you have. In a half hour, Francis Davis on Interval will be featuring some of the out-of-print work of Archie Shepp with the New York Contemporary Five. National Public Radio's program, NPR Journal, has produced a 13-part series on violent crime. We're going to hear another edition from this series now, and the subject of this program, as I mentioned before, is violence within the family.
From National Public Radio, this is NPR Journal.
Anybody speak English?
Yeah, I do. I'm just trying to find out what happened. Apparently, the next door neighbor was chasing her son with a rifle. This man that apparently is already in your custody was chasing her son with his rifle, threatening to shoot him. She caught it and asked him, hey, what the hell are you doing? You know, and let me get the rest of the info.
This program is one in a series that NPR Journal is producing on crime in America. This program is about domestic violence. It is produced by Kathy McAnally in San Francisco. In 1980, the candidates for president avoided the crime issue. It is a circular, almost bottomless problem, and perhaps reasons the candidates did not enter with observations or offer solutions are found in the nature of violence. There are many types of crime, and all can be quantified, tabulated, and categorized. But crime can't be explained simply or adequately addressed with additional police, greater community interaction, or improved economics. The home, in theory, is a place of safety, and yet the exact opposite is often the case.
What were they fighting about?
I don't know. We haven't had a chance to talk to the lady yet.
Hey, Captain.
Seven officers from the San Francisco Police Department responded to this particular call. The suspect was captured after a foot chase, during which all of the participants displayed guns.
There's nobody seems to be here. And the people upstairs, Gary, they just said he was arguing with somebody and they heard shots.
A shot?
They saw him with a rifle.
Several officers sustained minor injuries, scratches, bruises, and one sprained finger. Fortunately, no one was shot.
You did?
Yeah.
Inside.